The public knows CERN is a large physics research center in Switzerland, run by an intergovernmental organization of the same name. However, the secret levels where research by the occult world is conducted involves nightmarish things unimaginable to the general public. No one ever wants to go there. It makes visiting the Rothschild family and being their oracle seem like a walk in the park. Every father in our cult must do a rotation at CERN, where our main genetics laboratories are located, and now it is my turn. It is not unusual for the scientists, technicians, and other workers to have breakdowns after a period of time. The regular assessments were instituted several years ago as a part of a multi-pronged strategy to improve the mental health of those on their CERN rotations. The genetics lab at CERN are located in underground levels that the public has no awareness of. All the scientific and support staff in these labs are cult fathers. The other roles not requiring scientific or administrative skills, such as food prep, laundry, and cleaning, are done by mind-controlled individuals who are never allowed to leave CERN, and are killed and then replaced with new individuals about every half year. We consider this a necessary evil, as the stress of being underground around the horrors of CERN degrades the quality of even such menial work over time. Thus, new workers are needed. Furthermore, that they never get to leave CERN alive means that our secrets are kept secure. These levels can only be accessed through special elevators hidden in the more public levels of CERN and through special underground tunnels deep beneath the ground. The tunnels extend for many miles and have several openings above ground, far away from the facility. The openings are located in small villages run by the Knights of Malta, KOM, an occult society with close ties to ours. These knights, who look like ordinary villagers, have guarded these secret tunnel entrances and exits for many years. They have been trained to guard this secret with their lives if necessary, for the KOM are dedicated to our security. On the Italian side of the Alps, there are other tunnel entrances that are guarded by other groups, such as Opus Dei, with equal diligence. It is a week later, and I am driving myself and two other agents into Switzerland. The three of us have just spent a night and a day in the Italian Alps, enjoying the scenery to give us happy memories before going below ground. Now, we are crossing into Swiss territory. The other two agents are going to relieve two workers in the labs who are finishing their three-month rotation at the end of the week. No one likes going to CERN, and our expressions say it all, even if we cannot voice how we feel about this assignment. Good soldiers obey orders willingly. We are all excellent soldiers, or else we would be running screaming from the car, preferring to get shot for desertion rather than go down into the hell on earth that is CERN. The KOM soldiers, dressed as simple civilians but well-armed, see our car and our license plate and nod. We give them the security codes for the week. We still have to go through the biometric security procedures required: retinal scans, blood sample, voice and facial recognition. The computers scan the databases and give us permission to go on. The tunnel door opens in the side of a grassy hill, with goats grazing around the perimeter. As I drive the car into it, I feel as if I am actually driving the three of us into hell. After several minutes, we reach one of the underground parking lots. Once again, at the entrance into the labs, there are guards waiting, and we again pass through several rounds of security measures. The steel door lifts, and we walk in. The first thing I notice is the noise. It is high-pitched and eerie. It sounds like a human being in distress, but not quite. It is coming down from a well-lit hall. Thankfully, the office that I'm headed to is in the opposite direction of the noise. Nonetheless, it makes the hair on the back of my neck stand as I walk down the hall. We are greeted by two security officers, one of the lab technicians, and a haggard-looking trainer. I will be relieving this trainer, whose job has been to assess the mental health of the workers in the facility and provide interventions. I am startled to see a haunted look in his eyes, which are rimmed with dark circles. Father John is a very experienced and accomplished programmer as well as assassin. Considering that I had never seen him look this way, despite the horrifying things we have to do in the programming labs at occult rituals, we go towards a high-security bomb-proof door, where John places the pad of his third finger on a plate by it, and simultaneously speaks the security code for the day. The steel door opens, and I enter the genetic labs at CERN. We are on the first level, where our transhuman genetics experiments are being done, just ahead, to the left. I see a small cage with a creature that has a human-looking face with the tail of a cat. Fine tawny fur covers its body. While her features are partially human, her mentation is not. The cat creature snarls and lunges at me, striking hard the bars of her cage with her arms and shoulders. Her attempted attack is accompanied by a horrifying scream that peters off into a soft growl filled with malice. I can see with one glance that this creature is female as it has no clothes. I feel a pang of pity for it, even as my stomach turns in horror. Its face and form are still human enough to make its nakedness stand out. I barely keep myself from cringing away from her cage. She is the product of combining the DNA of a cheetah and a human in the hope of creating a super soldier capable of inhuman speed and strength. John pulls up her charts on the computer, which describes her genetic, emotional, social, and physical characteristics, as well as the results of her 5 most recent health assessments. Like many of these creatures, her physical health is now poor. She is not doing well with the stress of her environment in the labs, and is suffering from weaknesses caused by the genetic manipulation. Our research involves learning how to prevent the poor overall health, aggression, and low levels of intellect created when combining humans with animals. I feel ill as I go down the hall and see varying physical results of this trans-species genetic work. There are 2 small children, male and female, that look human until I spot their paws. They growl menacingly at me as I walk by, showing sharp canine teeth. I make a mental note to never get within reach of those teeth. I see other human-animal chimeras, combinations with chimpanzees, with birds, with fish, and other odd-appearing creatures. All of them, however, have a look of bland and resigned, yet intense rage in cold eyes that lets me know that given the opportunity, they would kill me in a minute. The terrible, almost human grunts, growls, and screams that they make sends chills down my spine and makes me weak at the knees. I am not sure whether to think of them as human, animal, or monster. The tour of this level seems to go on and on and on as John introduces me to the lab workers on this level. They are subjected to the horror day after day. It is no wonder that they are stressed, to understate matters. I see something else that few other facilities have, an alcohol dispensing machine stocked with the finest wines and liquors. The staff on the floor can unlock the drinks of their choice once their badge shows that they have completed their 8 hours on duty. I am not a drinker, but I plan to visit the lounge tonight and grab something alcoholic to help me sleep. It is unsurprising that alcohol overconsumption is common in the lab workers here. I have no doubt that my name is going to be added to that list of overconsumers over the next month. After showing me the well-equipped gym and large swimming pool next to the lounge, John takes me down to the next level. Both of us have to pass through even tighter security measures in order to enter and exit the elevator to our destination, the genetic labs that focus on human performance. Over many years of work here, and in a few other labs, we have identified the genetic sequences and the interactions between the genetic sequences that impact numerous characteristics like intelligence, sex, muscle mass, strength, health, eye color, hair color, height, and race. We can already reliably control these factors in our babies and are experimenting with new genetic development. To further advance our next generation of babies, we are still looking to improve our control over physical traits, such as the efficacy of muscle recruitment, healing, endurance, psychological traits such as loyalty, perseverance, will to live, creativity, and spiritual traits such as psychic ability, sensitivity to the spiritual realms, aptitude for traveling the dimensions, and so on. These labs are not as stressful as the ones above, and the staff are rotated between the 2 sets of labs to give those working with the transhumans desperately needed breaks. The lab technicians are carefully marking various sequences for further study. Depending on the experiment, the sequences are being spliced into eggs and sperm, or fertilized eggs, then stored in row upon row on special climate-controlled shelves. Besides just trying to study the outcomes of manipulating DNA, we have also been studying how the genetic engineering interacts with fertilization conditions as well as the environment of the womb. We continue to study each successfully born healthy child for several months to several years to identify the outcomes of the experiments. Once a particular series of experiments is deemed successful, we will use this knowledge to engineer the next batch of babies in our labs located in Rome itself. In front of each shelf is a series of DNA sequences on a label that shows the part of the human genetic strand that is being researched. In the lab, these tiny cultured beings are known by this genetic strand and not by name. Numbers are given to each zygote after implantation into its birth mother. The technicians raising these experimental children, however, do usually end up giving names to these children, rarely calling them by their numbers. I am excited about the work happening here, because at this point, I believe the indoctrination that the gifted children that we produce would create better soldiers and would make the world a better place. The next set of rooms down the hall, however, make my stomach heave again. To unknowing eyes, there is nothing at all upsetting or unusual about these rooms. In fact, they look like a spa or retreat center for wealthy women wanting the best of care and rest during pregnancy. The place is beautifully appointed and extremely comfortable. It seemingly houses many happy-looking women at various stages of pregnancy whose needs are monitored by extremely well-trained attendants. In truth, these women have been enslaved to be carriers for the human and transhuman genetic experiments that I have been viewing since I arrived at CERN. The ones being given the most careful attention are usually the ones carrying the worst of the transhuman experiments. These chimeric pregnancies have very high failure rates, so we give these mothers the most care. These women have been told that they are very privileged and will be rewarded highly for their work as surrogates. The truth is, however, in order to maintain the secrecy of CERN, every single one is killed once their use as healthy carriers has run out. Some of the women are not carrying genetic experiments, but rather genetic products. These are transhuman or genetically modified children specifically ordered by the extremely wealthy from various occult societies around the world. Common requests include children completely covered in fur, having a slightly animal-like appearance of those with both male and female genitals. Always, they request for these children to come with training upon delivery. We can deliver a broad number of designer products at a cost of only several million dollars each. Sales contracts specify that these children are not allowed to live past 2.5 years old. They are sterilized before being taken to their new owners. At times, individuals and families become attached to one of these special children, treating them as a pet, and have been reluctant to kill them at the end of the contract. We therefore have a failsafe, an implant that releases poison to kill the child by the specified time. The implant is placed where attempts at removal will kill the child. The limited lifespan of these children helps ensure that they remain highly sought after items. After this, John takes me to the next level, down to view the nurseries and labs where the experimental human children will live during the first year of their life. Those who live beyond this age are raised and monitored in a different facility. The nurseries look very much like the ones that the children are raised in, with the spaces, studios, and equipment for promoting and assessing the children's mental, emotional, social, physical, and spiritual development. The labs for assessing their levels of pain endurance, stamina, and responses to physical, emotional, and spiritual stress, however, make me queasy. On the farthest end of the level are the rooms for the autopsies and the disposals of the bodies of the children who do not survive the outcome of their genetic manipulations, or do not survive the testing of their ability to endure pain, disease, and stress. There is an observable hierarchy in how the transhumans are treated. The more human the chimera looks, the better it is treated. If they can speak a few words, all the better. Those that can talk a little are given less unnecessary abuse and more time, attention, and nurture. The more animalistic children, on the other hand, consistently receive less nurture and more violence to keep them in line. Unlike the more human children, they cannot cry when slapped or hit. Instead, they bite and growl and fight back at their tormentors, for this is how they view their captors, and rightly so. The difference in treatment bothers me deeply, even though I know that it is one way that the staff are coping. My evenings are spent in meetings with John and the other trainers to review the findings and discuss intervention plans for each staff member and strategies for making working conditions more tolerable. the deep darkness that seems to surround the labs beneath the ground, a darkness that is more than just twice daily sacrifices made to the gods in all our labs. This is a darkness that seems born out of trying to be gods and to create new beings, to improve upon what has been originally created, to develop new species. Like all cult trainers, I was sent there at intervals for years, for periods that varied between 4 weeks and 6 weeks, to do these assessments and provide counseling for those who worked there. I had nightmares for weeks after these memories came up, and helped myself through that time of remembering by reassuring myself I survived being there the first time, and I can survive remembering. I can remember and stay sane. I had to counteract several layers of security and amnesia barriers and punishments designed to prevent ever revealing the secret of the cults, their transhuman and genetic experimentation. I had to deal with the sadness and despair as well that welled up as I realized that human beings are actually capable of doing the kinds of things done at the labs underneath CERN. And yet, in spite of the emotional and spiritual cost of participating in this, continuing to do so. Just for the record, if anyone should go into the isolated Swiss villages searching for the tunnel entrances I describe here, I highly advise against doing so. The agents of the Knights of Malta that guard them will first attempt to divert anyone coming near. But if all other methods fail, they are trained to create accidents that are fatal for those without authorization who are too inquisitive. I am 30 years old, and a team of cult fathers, of which I am one, is meeting with a delegation from China in a suburb south of Beijing. The delegation from Beijing is interested in a proposal that the cults have put forward. We have offered to help them develop a world-class training facility in one of their underground facilities in order to create an army that will be dedicated to bringing in the long-expected leader that their own prophets and wise men have told them will come soon, within a generation or two. After an hour of murmured polite greetings and talk, Simon, the cult first general, starts the discussion that led to our being here. "We would like to create a vast underground facility in your country in the northeast," Simon says. "It will look like this." He continues and clicks a button that displays a blueprint of the proposed facility and another button that creates a 3D hologram image of what it will look like once constructed. Both your countries and ours would together provide sufficient zygotes and birth mothers to develop an initial prototype group of 100 based upon the best of our genetics research from the last 25 years. At this point, Simon clicks to display a video that shows a group of older teenage soldiers performing military exercises extremely well. These teens are well-muscled, and in some of the maneuvers displayed, show excellent critical thinking and strategic skills in various simulated situations. When a large holographic image of a blonde, blue-eyed man appears on the screen above the room they are in, the soldiers all salute with complete adoration in their eyes. In one exercise, the holographic image gives the command to one soldier to kill the comrade next to him, and unhesitatingly, the soldier obeys. As you can see, our initial prototypes, developed in an underground facility in Poland, have been quite successful, Simon continues. If you agree to our proposal, we could together develop and train 100,000 special soldiers over a period of 30 years. We, of course, would share our genetic and other technologies with you and implement them in the facility at only a third of the cost to you, with the order taking on the other two-thirds of the cost. You will end up with a state-of-the-art training facility that will be completely hidden, one that will ensure your position as a world leader in the coming order. At the end of a month, with further meetings and negotiations, an agreement is made. Beneath the ground, within an hour's drive of Beijing, an underground facility will be developed, a facility that will be modern, with the majority built at our expense, with the proviso that our methods and our trainers will be in charge, but with extensive peer help and administration from the Chinese trainers. Our contract states that the Chinese trainers will be able to review and give suggestions regarding what is being done at all times. All parties are satisfied, and the Beijing facility will become a reality within 5 years. It will be connected to Beijing by an underground tunnel, and the provinces of China, along with other countries surrounding China, will provide the infants and birth mothers that will be used to create a literal army of soldiers trained to have complete loyalty to the coming world leader. These soldiers will never leave their facilities, They will never experience life in a family setting or have contact with others who are not part of the occult world. Therefore, they are not programmed with non-cult presentation parts who are amnesic to the cult. Instead, they will have specialized loyalty programming to this coming leader and will be programmed to be willing to lay down their lives for his sake. We have created virtual reality programs based upon the painting of the light of the world that are a fair simulation of what this world leader will look like. For we believe that he will be coming soon, indeed, if the oracles are right in their predictions. It is 8 months later, and the fathers and I are meeting with a delegation from Russia in St. Petersburg. It is winter, and the temperatures are sub-freezing in a snow-covered landscape. Our goal is the same as when meeting with leadership in China, to build an underground training facility, and there to develop soldiers and military sub-captains who will not have the complex presentation programming seen in agents who must be hosted and imprisoned in various countries or identities. Instead, just as in China, these soldiers will be raised from birth to respond with unshakable loyalty and obedience to images and videos of the coming world leader and to view him as a father figure and deep attachment bond for their systems. We present this plan to the Russian leaders, and after 3 weeks of discussion, they give the response and agree. For Russia also wants to play a leading role in the coming order and wants to help build the army that will usher in his rule. Just as in China, the soldiers will be programmed to speak and understand a variety of languages and to comply with complete love and obedience to any requests that this coming leader will make. The army for the New World Order is building as the cult fathers and I make plans to visit Africa, the United States, South America, and remote areas near Nepal in the near future for the same purpose. There are numerous underground training facilities around the world, with new underground facilities built after the success of the initial ones. What makes the programming done in China, Russia, and the other countries mentioned unique is the fact that this new generation of soldiers will have programming to obey the leader of the New World Order, and the trainers do not bother to put in presentation programming for other countries or identities, since these soldiers will never leave the facility until it is time to take orders from the coming leader. These facilities have above-ground areas as well, but the grounds are all carefully hidden from public view, whether above or below ground, with blackout of any satellite coverage, which intelligence in countries around the world is aware of and programmed to not take note of. These soldiers comprise literally a completely dedicated army of thousands upon thousands being programmed in this way, and represents the belief by the cults and other countries around the world that the coming world leader will come upon the scene soon, very soon. Our first success was with a young white homeless man purchased from a trafficker in Europe. We did not know his name or his story, and did not care to know. To us then, he was not a person, but a scientific subject. Lizzie straps him down, then enters the command into the machine to stimulate the neural patterns of rage. I watch the man, not expecting much. The microburst waves are invisible to the human eye, so despite the millions of dollars poured into the project by this point, there is literally nothing to see. Then, the man lets out a howl of rage that barely sounds human. The howl continues as he strains at his straps with all of his strength. It breaks off as he pauses for breath, his heart rate sky high, pupils fully dilated, then resumes screams of mindless rage. Lizzie herself catches a breath, then cues the machine to stop. Within 2 seconds, the man is silent, panting. He looks around at us. He was frightened when he was first brought in. Now, we can see that he is confused and twice as frightened as before. Do it again. I snap out an order. We have to know if we are indeed seeing what we are seeing, a first success. I can sense that the other team members are equally tense. Lizzie gives the machine a command. Again, the man screams and writhes in a rage. After 10 seconds, I lift my hand. From years of working together, Lizzie understands my silent gesture and stops the waveform stimulation. Once again, the man's rage passes and he gazes around the room, eyes round with terror and bewilderment. We put him for this torture 2 more times. Each time, exactly the same thing happens. The team's excitement mounts with each successful display of direct control of the man's emotions. Lizzie then unstraps the man and puts him back into a cage with food and water in the adjoining room. It took many more years of work and great harm to thousands of what the order labeled experimental subjects to develop this technology into an effective programming tool. We called it the God Machine because it was God to those programmed by its use. We also called it Shiva after the spiritual being who we believe gave us the inspiration and part of the scientific knowledge for its development. The machine's most basic design is that of a small rectangular chamber, not unlike a coffin that the subject lies in, then the lid is closed. The walls and lid of the machine are comprised of panels that display the scenarios for the programming session, such as a starry sky, the pit of hell, the person's therapist's office, the person's presentation home in America, and so on. Special glasses are also placed over the person's eyes. These glasses interact with the walls and lid and the waveforms to create extremely realistic experiences. For instance, the programmers can have the person look down at his left arm and see it on fire while the machine stimulates that arm to feel the horrendous pain of the burning, fully accompanied by the smell of burning flesh. The machine is precise enough that it can even start the burning at the tips of the fingers, then cause the sensations of the burning flames to slowly crawl up the hand, then arms, accompanied by the relevant visuals. When not playing back the programming scenes, the walls and lid are transparent. The machine monitors neural responses, vital signs, and other parameters. The chamber is built such that IV lines, feeding tubes, catheters, and other medical devices can be used without disrupting the programming scenarios when necessary for longer programming sessions. Different sizes of the machine chambers are used for subjects of different ages. Programming installed by the God Machine is considered unbreakable because the individual is entrained by hour after hour after hour of cyclic repetition of stimulus and response that goes deep within the various brain states. Like a tractor wheel plowing through mud, this entertainment creates neural ruts of cognition and emotion and behavior for parts, according to the programmer's precise design, that are robust and difficult to change. Such programming is also considered more effective because the direct neural manipulation downloads the desired program response to that person while preventing the individual's own response to the programming. For instance, traditional techniques to program an assassin make them enjoy killing, involving intense conditioning through praise, treats, and other rewards from the trainer, and often, the administration of drugs that create a sense of bliss and or thrill. Nonetheless, the part may still feel twinges of unease at the bottom of their stomach, or pangs of guilt, shame or pity for the target, especially when they are still very young. The programmers also have to ensure that the person's negative feelings about killing, such as horror, are being disassociated correctly into the right parts or locations in the system, directed stimulus of emotion, thought and action. The part being conditioned to deeply associate killing with joy will not experience any twinges of guilt or discomfort or have negative emotions that need to be seconded to other emotion-holding parts in the system. The part's entire experience is that of joy at killing. At my last point of contact with the Order, portable or mobile versions of the technology that looked like a helmet, used in combination with a full bodysuit, had already been in use for over a decade. A younger survivor who has recently left the Order told me that they can now record the experience of one person, then download this experience onto another person. For instance, they can record one person's pleasurable experience of eating a chocolate croissant, then download this experience onto another person. Similarly, they can record an experience of brutal torture on one person, then download this onto a different person, enabling them to put this next person through all the pain and terror, yet with actual little physical damage. I have also heard that this, or similar technologies, can be used to read a person's dreams or thoughts remarkably well, though not fully precisely yet. Note, while I do believe that such advanced mind-reading technology has been developed, I am also aware that in order to enhance their control and discourage parts from daring to think independently, programmers do use many tricks to persuade parts that they can read their minds or read their dreams, spiritually, psychically, or through the use of technology. Often, these tricks are accomplished through other parts in the survivor having already reported the thoughts or dreams, unbeknownst to the parts currently being told that their own thoughts and dreams are not safe from the programmers. Many groups have worked hard to develop similar technologies, meaning that many survivors from different groups would have memories of high-tech programming involving direct brain stimulation. According to my memories, there was something of a race between the different occult societies and government agencies as far back as the 50s and 60s to create devices to directly control a person's brain and mind, and to develop effective protocols for integrating the use of these devices into programming over areas of development that cult scientists engage in, including weaponry, transportation and communication technologies, agricultural technologies, climate control technologies, and medical technologies. In fact, the medical advances in the order, unknown still to the public, enables them to heal many types of injuries from torture, programming accidents, training accidents, incidences on missions, and so on, without leaving any scars.